Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
Oh man, 1 billion Americans white paper contest.
Oh yeah, it's huge. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Ezra Klein, who is back from vacation, tanned, rested, ready. And I wanted to make him talk about, first, the Veep Stakes, which we discussed previously on the show, but has changed, I think, since our discussion. Kamala Harris is still very much in contention, but I think a lot of the other people we talked about have slipped somewhat, at least in the rumor mongering. And two other people who we didn't talk about have really rocketed up. Susan Rice, who was national security advisor and UN ambassador under President Obama, and is not, I don't think Susan Rice is that well known a public figure, but like journalists, like people who covered the Obama administration, at least, like, know all about her. And Karen Bass, a House member from California, who I will admit I had only the vaguest idea who she was until she came up in the Veep Stakes. As just a California guy, maybe knows her better.
I'm thrilled at 2 out of 3 of the Veep Stake finalists being Californians.
Yeah, it's a critical swing state. very, very logical that Democrats would be focusing on that. So, you know, I mean, I think we talked already about sort of like general philosophy of Veeping, but like, what do you think about these contenders?
So this is why Matt, I think, alluded a little bit. I had some resistance to this conversation. And it's mostly because I love like speculating about Veep Stakes, but the information about it is bad. And so I say everything like the internet rationalist, like epistemic status, like low confidence here. So my sense of what I'm reading in the reporting and what my own reporting is showing is that Kamala Harris should probably be understood as the front runner. Susan Rice is there with her, and Karen Bass has fallen a little bit, in part because of vetting issues. So there was a clip rocketing around where she was praising Scientology because they had opened up a center in her district. There's some stuff about her in Cuba. None of it is really that bad, and maybe it's not going to knock her out, but it's just the kind of thing that a politician who's like a good like local politician who did not think they'd be in a VP contention might do, whereas like ambitious long-term politicians who are thinking about themselves as potential presidents are a little more careful on. So my sense is her star has fallen a little bit, though that could change. The Harris-Rice contention is interesting because my understanding of it is basically that Joe Biden would pick Susan Rice if it were just up to him. He likes Susan Rice from the Obama administration. Biden's heart is in foreign policy. Obviously, Susan Rice is a foreign policy person. When you ask Joe Biden questions, he defaults to talking about foreign policy. I was on a call with him the other day, and he got asked a question about racial equity, and he began by talking about how racism in America makes America look bad on the world stage. He thinks very frontally about America's leadership in the world. He's very concerned about what Donald Trump has done to that. And so I think he likes Susan Rice a lot. The issue is Susan Rice the main thing people know her for, quite unfairly, is the Megassi talking points issue. Beyond that, she's just not known that well. She has not ever run for anything. And so it's just like, it's a real gamble of a pick in terms of campaigning. Whereas Kamala Harris, who I don't think Biden and even his team like as much, is understood to be a very competent campaigner, has been vetted in the sense of being able to be under the spotlight in a national campaign, ticks a lot of good boxes for them, you know, is well-liked in the Senate. And so, like, Kamala Harris is the one they think they should go with, and Susan Rice is the one that on some level, I think Joe Biden's heart is with.
I think that's right. I also think that this whole selection, at least how it's been framed for the public, has been a little bit, not just a little bit, but actually, like, a lot misguided. I guess you call them Biden allies or Chris Dodd, and people who know Chris Dodd have, I think, really poisoned the waters around this dialogue by being quite public in their hostility to Harris in, I would say, pretty blatantly sexist terms, that like she's too ambitious and she wasn't respectful enough to Biden during the campaign.
Well, I think the line was she didn't show remorse for attacking him.
Yeah, and
which was a weird line, given that it was a campaign.
Right, and like those are just not good reasons, right? If you accept the contrary premise, which seems very prevalent among Democratic Party campaign operatives, particularly the younger cohort of them than like the Chris Dodds of the world, that Kamala Harris is this like very talented, charismatic, dynamic politician, then there's absolutely no reason to hold against her the fact that she's clearly ambitious for higher office, or that she said mean things about her opponent while in an election, because that's actually what you want, right? Like, I think you want a VP who, you know, whose ideas you think are good, but there's no huge ideological void between Biden and Harris. And you want a VP who will be hardworking and tough and good at politics. And, you know, all the like obvious concerns about Susan Rice are that, like, what if she has to lead the Democratic Party? Like, does she have any experience or ability with that? At the same time, I'm just not sure it's true that Kamala Harris is such a skilled or appealing or charismatic politician. I mean, her record is fine. I don't have any big problem with her. But like her campaign was really bad, I thought, like just looking at it. And it reflected, it seemed to me, both a lack of a natural base for her. There was nobody really except for Democratic Party staffers who was like super hyped about Kamala Harris. She made weird tactical choices. She got very few votes. And it just like, it makes me wonder, like, why did we give up on the idea of a swing state governor like Gretchen Whitmer, who has won tough races? How did it come down to Harris as like the political pick, and then Rice as this slightly, I mean, I get it on Rice, right? It's not just that that Biden cares about foreign policy, but like literally he knows Susan Rice. Like they worked together in the Obama administration for a long time. Biden is very old. He needs a vice president who is substantially younger than he is, but there aren't a lot of people of that age cohort who he has actually worked with in the same way that he has Rice. But like the fact that she's not a politician at all just seems like a huge red flag. But then like, I don't quite get how the field got this narrow. It seems based on a false premise about Kamala Harris's appeal to the electorate.
So I want to move this a little bit because I could speculate on how it got that narrow, but I don't know how useful that speculation would be.
Right.
But to the case for and against some of the front runners here, let me talk about Susan Rice a little bit more on the merits. And I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts here because I'm a little bit less of a foreign policy guy than you are. You wrote a book on foreign policy. You've covered these issues over time more closely than I have. I said in our last sweepstakes conversation that the most important thing in a vice president is that the president actually trusts them. Because a vice president who is let into the room, who is considered a serious advisor, like that really matters. And it is continuously the case that the president, and for that matter, on some level, the vice president, even more so, they just have a lot more running room on foreign policy than they do on legislative policy. Like, what's really going to matter for whether or not Joe Biden gets his agenda passed is whether or not Chuck Schumer is majority leader and how many votes Nancy Pelosi actually has under control. Whether you pick Karen Bass or Kamala Harris or Susan Rice really doesn't matter there. Whereas in some of the things that I think Joe Biden like wants to do when he sits awake thinking about his presidency at night, which is like rebuilding international agreements, rebuilding American leadership in the world, I think he would really trust Susan Rice as his emissary there, right? He would really like imbue her with a lot of authority that he may not trust Kamala Harris with. He may not trust Karen Bass with, not because he wouldn't like them, but just because that, you know, he, Biden, in every interview he's ever given about these issues, like he puts a lot of emphasis on the fact that he knows the names of every world leader. And like, so does Susan Rice. And so to the extent of that is how Biden thinks about things in terms of international relationships, like renegotiating us into the Paris Climate Agreement, things like that, I think he would give her a lot of power. The counter question there is, like, what do you actually think of Susan Rice as a foreign policy thinker? That's a little bit of a trickier idea than one might imagine, given how high level her roles have been, because she served in the Obama administration, ultimately serving out President Obama's foreign policy, was also, of course, responsible for crafting it. But across the many roles she's had in Democratic-aligned foreign policy politics, and she helped create a big, I think it was a CNAS report, you know, or before the Obama administration, it's all very kind of conventional, like, America should lead in a multilateral world, but it very much backs up Joe Biden's somewhat conventional foreign policy. Whereas I thought one of the real strengths of the Bernie Sanders campaign or some of the other campaigns in the Democratic Party was like really questioning where the Democratic Party has been on foreign policy over the years. So for instance, Susan Rice appears to be, from what we know, have been pro the Libyan intervention, which I don't think is considered to have turned out that well. She's known for being regretful about what happened in Rwanda, about the degree to which the Clinton administration, which she was part of, did not respond when she was there. So I don't know, I don't have a good sense of what Susan Rice's great foreign policy triumphs are. And so while the affirmative case for me is that Biden respects her and trusts her, in terms of the affirmative case of Susan Rice being the person who is crafting foreign policy for America, which could be the case if she becomes president, for all that that's like the selling point for her, I don't feel like I fully understand what that would look like if she were empowered to do it herself.
Yeah, and this is why podcasts are good, because, you know, I had the idea a little while back. I was like, okay, I'm going to revisit what I remember, and I'm going to get in touch with some people, and I'm going to report this out, and I'm going to like explain what Susan Rice believes or where she stands, you know, relative to the Democratic Party. And what I came up with is pretty unsatisfactory and just didn't make for a good article. But here we can talk about it in words like human beings. But you know, one person who worked with her for a while told me that she is enigmatic. Another person who follows this stuff very closely from a left-wing perspective, I was just trying to ask him, like, you know, is she of the mainstream establishment people? Would she say she's like better than average or worse than average from your point of view? And he told me, no, she's exactly average. And, you know, she has this interesting profile, which is she worked for Bill Clinton's administration at a relatively low level. She was very young then, but, you know, important jobs for a successful, smart, well-regarded person, but not at the top level. And then she was out of office, you know, as people were, because George W. Bush was president. And when Howard Dean started to catch fire as a, you know, an anti-war candidate, he clearly needed some foreign policy advisors, because he was like, you know, he was the governor of this small state. He was a medical doctor. He's not really a foreign policy guy, but the whole point of his campaign was that the Iraq War was a mistake. And so Susan Rice was probably the highest profile person who signed on to his campaign from the national security world. And there was a big risk with her. You know, there was a real impulse toward solidarity among Democratic Party foreign policy pros to say, like, we shouldn't break the seal on this. We shouldn't say, like, we all fucked up by backing Bush here. But she did. Then 2008, the Obama-Hillary Clinton race on foreign policy had a similar dynamic. And she was a prominent Obama person. And, you know, had Hillary Clinton won that primary and become president, I think Susan Rice's career in foreign policy would be over. But Obama won, and he made her UN ambassador, which is a traditional way station to becoming Secretary of State. Then the feeling was she was unconfirmable as Secretary of State because of Benghazi and some other things. And she became National Security Advisor, which is not the highest status job in foreign policy, but it's the one where you were in the room with the President of the United States a lot, right? She was the person who Obama wanted to work with. He wanted to bounce ideas off her, and he saw her as good at being an honest broker, you know, who would represent what different people's thoughts were and help him make decisions about things. I think there was a lot of frustration in terms of, like, how do we characterize the Obama doctrine, right? There was, like, the famous thing where he said, like, let's not do dumb shit, you know, which, like, it looks good compared to doing dumb shit, but doesn't have a ton of theoretical heft to it. And Rice, to the best of my knowledge, reflects that. Not that, you know, her idea carried the way in every step of the Obama administration, but the whole thing of, like, intervening in Libya, then feeling a little chastened by that, and then not intervening in Syria, and being, you know, kind of dovish on Russia, then getting more hawkish after they invaded Crimea, but not as hawkish as the Republicans were. And then, you know, the whole 2016 election happened, and maybe that didn't work out right. But, you know, it's just like trying to be measured, not have a drastic revision of America's role in the world, but also not have this grandiose kind of vision of it. Her book, you know, was an interesting memoir of, like, life in Washington and foreign policy, but I think is not a great, like, theoretical tome, right, on international relations theory. She's a very experienced at the political aspects of foreign policy, though, like working on campaigns. She staffed Michael Dukakis way back in 1988, which all sort of makes her well suited to the for someone who seems unsuited to the vice presidency. She's better suited than you might think. She, like, knows a lot about politics. She literally grew up in Washington, D.C. with parents who worked in government and politics. But I couldn't give you, like, a great two-paragraph summary of, like, this is what she's all about. Nor could I really about Biden, right? Who, like...
I was going to say that as you're describing that, it's just, like, that's how I described Joe Biden, too.
Right, exactly.
So, not literally in terms of being a staffer, because obviously he's been a principal for a lot of it, but functionally what Joe Biden has been is, like, he is at the center of the Democratic Party and always has been.
Yes. And Rice is more like, I think she was on the left of the Democratic Party, and the party has moved closer to where she is and to where she stands, which is totally reasonable sort of track record and background for a VP. But I mean, it's weird, right? I mean, it goes back to Biden, who, as you say, Biden really cares about foreign policy, but it's not super obvious what the Biden doctrine itself is exactly, other than, like, on the highest level, that we should be sort of more high toned and decent and care about alliances than Trump. It's weird, right? The idea of a foreign policy-centric pick by a foreign policy-centric president or presidential nominee, in which it's difficult to characterize what their foreign policy is, seems odd to me, but possibly where we would land on this.
But I think it reflects Biden generally, and in a funny way, I think it also reflects the Kamala Harris option. This is an argument I've made in a couple of pieces, but I think something very distinctive about Biden as a candidate is it he is running as if he is the leader in a parliamentary system. He is running very much as a party leader. He does not represent a sharply ideological faction in the fight. To the degree he was coded as a moderate when he won, he didn't say, ha-ha, the moderates control the party now. He said, okay, we're going to create a bunch of task forces with the Bernie Sanders people and come together around a big tent coalition. And in the same way that Joe Biden himself has always just been in the center of the Democratic Party, working closely with like every faction of the Democratic Party establishment, to the degree that is like somewhat true for Susan Rice, who has been, you know, in the center of the Democratic Party, working at least with big parts of the Democratic Party establishment, though obviously took a side in the aftermath of the Iraq War. Kamala Harris has some of that quality as well. One thing that I found difficult on the Harris in covering the Harris campaign is, because all the way back, if you go and read her announcement speech, it was never clear to me what it was about exactly. I don't think they ever defined that at all. I don't think she ever had a definition of that. At the same time, a lot of her policies were really good. She came out with the LIFT Act, which was an earned income tax credit expansion. It's a really good policy. The way she got to her ultimate healthcare plan was bad. It was like a lot of fumbling around, and they did this sort of 10-year cost gimmick, which didn't make any sense. But the final healthcare plan was pretty good. I mean, it was an interesting way of actually expanding what Medicare truly is, which is a public-centered program with a private option inside of it, and making that the entire system. It was actually a pretty clever synthesis, which reflect her working with, I think, pretty smart health policy experts inside the Democratic Party coalition. She's, you know, well-liked in the Senate. It's unclear what she has a very liberal voting record, but both because of her past as a prosecutor and because of the way she positions herself, she's not understood primarily as a factional liberal. She is like understood as somebody who is, you know, will vote with the liberal Democrats, but kind of goes back and forth on individual issues. So again, a little bit like Biden, she brings together different parts of the party inside of her. That's true for Susan Rice. It's true in a different way, actually, for Karen Bass. And it just, people talk about the Democratic Party establishment, and that can mean many different things. To some degree, the party establishment reflects whoever the president is. So even though Barack Obama was always a little bit more of an establishment figure quickly than he admitted. Like when he came in, he took a bunch of Daschle and Gephardt staffers, so staffers from the congressional leaders, into his own office. And he in some ways represented the congressional wing against the Clintonite wing, which was always a very interesting factional and internal battle. But he was very much an establishment figure. But he also represented pretty distinct breaks on certain issues like the Iraq War. Joe Biden, just in everything he is doing, in who he is thinking about picking for VP and how he's conducted his own campaign, just like truly seems to represent this idea that the Democratic Party is a big tent. He wants kind of like everybody, like even vaguely inside of it, to feel reasonably welcome there. And he is intent on picking people who are just going to help him work with the Democratic Party as it exists today, be that its House structure, its Senate structure, its foreign policy structure. He wants people who can make overtures to other parts of the party, but won't offend parts of the party by being chosen. In a way, it is distinctive in how undistinctive it is, like to what you were just saying about a foreign policy pick who doesn't have a clear view, who doesn't represent a clear foreign policy vision. Like, I just think that reflects the Biden candidacy all the way around. And in some ways, I think it is a quite honest way of running for president. Like, it is in fact the case that the president has to work with their foreign policy establishment or spend a lot of time fighting it. It is, in fact, the case the president on legislation is going to have to work with the congressional establishment and will have to bow to what the congressional establishment ultimately wants. And so for Biden to just like from the ground up build his administration that way and make it very clear that like what Joe Biden thinks is a little bit subordinate to what the Democratic Party thinks, and Joe Biden is going to act broadly as a vessel, making some tweaks and changes on the margins to what that is or what he thinks that is. Like, that is really how his administration is going to work. And it is just funny how much it is a break from the Trump administration, where Trump, like, simultaneously comes in as his challenge to the party he is seeking to lead, but also is very lazy and disinterested. So just outsources huge amounts of policy to the party he supposedly beat. And so his entire administration is this very weird mishmash. Whereas, you know, I think Joe Biden is just creating an integrated party structure from the beginning, and everybody he's considering just reflects that in one way or another.
But here is where I do think that Harris and Biden contrast in a way that's important for campaigning, right? Which is that if you think about Biden's primary, he was the Twitter is not real life candidate. He was the candidate whose constituency was old people, people without college degrees, whose outreach to African Americans involved churches and like old bulls from the Congressional Black Caucus. And Harris was all the way on the other side of that, I think. Like, she had the most extremely online campaign of anybody who was out there, and with the exception of maybe Julian Castro, was the one who was most plugged into, I don't want to say it, I don't want to use pejorative words, but to the like tendency to take radical academic concepts about race and gender identity, import them through highly educated young media and congressional staff people and put them out. And this Michigas with Chris Dodd is very emblematic of that, right? Like, this is like literally super old guys who both don't care that what they're saying plays as sexist and also seem to not actually know that it's counterproductive, that it's going to cause people to rally around Harris. Whereas Harris is a mastermind of executing exactly that sort of rally, right? Like, professional women and the sense of being punished for ambition and that she is a vehicle for this, right? Like, she's very skilled at playing in that niche, which has served her incredibly well at rising to the top of California statewide politics, which is, it's fucking hard because I like, how many of you live in California? It's like 80 billion people, right? And you still just have two senators. So it's really, really...
it's a shame.
No, right. But so it's so hard to become a statewide elected Democrat in California, but you don't need to beat Republicans.
I'm going to interrupt you here just because that was not her strategy in California. I mean, to everything you're saying, I think there's something to it. I don't actually buy this interpretation as much. She had a pretty online staff and did do some of what you're talking about. But I think her candidacy didn't actually, part of the problem for a candidacy was it never represented any one thing. It wasn't even fully bought in on that. But also part of the tensions in it were when she rose up in California, she didn't act that way at all. And so that's where all the stuff of like Kamala Harris is a cop. I mean, she in some ways in her California incarnation was a very Democratic establishment, like, you know, a reformer as a prosecutor, but still quite tough on crime. She was good friends with Beau Biden, Joe Biden's son. They were both attorney generals at the same time. The politics she was operating in California were, like, I would call them like an early aughts politics, right? It wasn't that she wasn't a liberal, because California's a liberal place, and so she was. But it reflected a lot of the more traditional ideas about which parts of liberalism are unpopular. Ideas that Joe Biden agrees with. And part of why the Harris-Biden conflict of that early debate was painful for Biden personally is he felt he and Harris had like a special bond because Harris and Beau Biden were so close. But one reason Harris and Beau Biden were so close is they were both like, they were both attorney generals representing the same kind of like mainstream liberal tendencies at the same time. So I'm a little bit less bought in your argument here. I'm not saying that wasn't reflected somewhat in her campaign, but both in her Senate incarnation and as an attorney general, like, she's risen up by like kind of understanding what her jobs are at the time she has them. I think actually her campaign was a place where she was least able to do that as president. She comes to the Senate in 2016, and there's a lot of hype around her from the beginning for a variety of reasons, but she's able to not collapse under that. And she does a pretty good job in hearings. She does a bunch of different things that are able to make her somebody who's a credible presidential candidate, really just a couple of years later. And she runs a reasonably credible campaign. I mean, she drops out somewhat early, but I think because of a clear-eyed sense she wasn't going to win, she was still doing better, say, when she dropped out than even, say, Cory Booker was, or some other people who stayed in quite a bit longer. So there's some real skill there. But the question of, like, how she would integrate with a Biden operation is, I think, a pretty open one.
All right, let's take a break. Let's talk about our serious topic.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
This week on The Pitch, would you like fries with that?
People are what make franchises run. The person who knows the business inside and out. Yep. Not someone who came off Wall Street because their check clears. Franchairs is the first investment marketplace where people can invest in franchises.
So you said $800 billion is what this market is a year. And hundreds of businesses are actually franchised businesses.
Oh, thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
There are more brands franchised than there are stocks on the NASDAQ.
Oh.
You're raising a $4 million price round.
And what are the terms on that?
The $19 million post-money valuation.
And you, do you not think that the valuation is a little frothy?
This week, things get frothy when Kenny Rose brings a new alternative investment class to retail investors. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch wherever you listen to podcasts.
So something that I've been tracking for the past couple of months and thinking a lot about is that in a way that people predicted, but I think is still worthy of note, Donald Trump's anti-democratic, semi-strongman tendencies are coming out in a more and more clear way as he falls in the polls. And there are a bunch of different pieces of this, but a lot of it put together is genuinely scary, even if he doesn't have the popularity or the institutional support to really drive it home. So, I mean, you have, for instance, the dispatch of federal agents to operate in reasonably violent ways against protesters, and clearly in part to create a conflict Donald Trump hoped he would profit from. It doesn't appear to have worked out that way. But what they were doing in Portland, the idea of also going to Chicago and other places, I mean, Donald Trump was hoping the protests and like the quote unquote anarchy that came from them would catapult his issues, like his grievances, his cultural conflicts back to the front of American politics. It didn't work out for him. So then he like tried to reestablish it by using the government and basically government stormtroopers to create another kind of conflict. Genuinely scary, I think. The tweet, which he pinned to the top of his account for some part of a day that, you know, we should delay the election. That was something that, you know, people laughed at Joe Biden for saying Donald Trump would suggest. And then, of course, Donald Trump suggested it. He got pretty decisively smacked down by the Republican Party there. In his own administration, his chief of staff said it wouldn't happen. Kevin McCarthy, the Republican House leader, said it wouldn't happen. Lindsey Graham said it shouldn't happen. I mean, it didn't. It was a trial balloon that failed. But it was a trial balloon. Like, the president of the United States really did say, let's just delay the election. All the attacks on vote by mail, which could lead to a very scary period. Like, let's say Donald Trump successfully demonizes voting by mail among his party. And so it's Democrats who vote by mail. So when the election is counted up on election day, Donald Trump is leading because Democrats are overwhelmingly not getting coronavirus by voting by mail. So it takes a week to see that they won, even potentially quite decisively. We saw this in 2018, for instance. It took quite some time to see how big the Democratic House wave was because, for instance, California votes by mail very heavily. But there's a lot going on here that I think is really concerning. Like, in some conceptual way, should like lead to Donald Trump's impeachment and removal, but nobody's going to do that this close to an election. It's a good thing that Trump has been so bumbling that he doesn't have support from like the military, for instance, to execute on any of this. And increasingly doesn't seem to have that much support even from Republicans to execute on any of it. But the fact that we really do have a president who is openly stating and openly dispatching federal agents and resources in a very strongman, authoritarian, anti-democratic kind of way. And so clearly, if anybody would give him rope to do that or it would work, he would go all in on it. I just feel it's worthy of more alarm than it's getting.
Yes, I agree with that. You know, one thing that I think makes this hard to talk about, or not hard to talk about, it's easy to talk about, but hard to sort of understand, is that there are, I think, multiple different dimensions of activity that people kind of characterize as authoritarian. And Trump is partakes of all of them, but they have very different kind of valences, and they exist differently in terms of like how we should understand what's going on exactly, right? So one of them is this policing stuff, right? Like, you know, you could read psychological literature about authoritarian personalities, or just look at the rhetoric of law and order over, you know, the history of the United States. And it's clear that there is one line of thought is that like the cops need to be in charge and you got to listen to them. There was a Rod Dreher piece where he was saying his big takeaway was, you know, he looked back at the George Floyd footage and people were getting the whole story wrong because he would still be alive today if he hadn't resisted arrest. And clearly, like, Dreher in his mind found this to be a very compelling point. To me, the idea that you would just execute somebody for not immediately following police orders, like, that was the issue, right? Like the issue was never that, like, he was literally just murdered totally randomly out of the blue. It's that the police officers undertook it upon themselves to kill somebody because he was being disobedient, right? So that's authoritarian, I think. And Trump does that. Trump is that kind of guy. Dara Lynn, when she was writing for us, she called it law and order versus the rule of law. And Trump is like all about that stuff. A totally different thing, but that also comes together with Trump, is highbrow, principled, conservative movement hostility to electoral democracy, where the fanciest, best conservatives you can find, the ones you would have the best time having lunch with, who are like nice, smart people who read good books, not like weird thug cop people, they think that majority rule is a bad idea. They think that because the median voter's income is lower than the national mean, that electoral democracy leads to income redistribution, which is immoral and retards long-term economic growth. So it is good and important to have counter-majoritarian institutions that preserve what they would consider classical liberalism, right? And this has been a thing in liberal political thought for centuries, that like maybe you don't want people to just vote because that will lead to too much redistribution of income and property. And Trump, you know, Trump is not that kind of guy. He's not like a Burkean political theorist, but his whole power, right? Like the reason he's president is that the Electoral College made him president. The reason that he has continued to be a potent force after getting smacked down in the midterms is that Republicans retain a majority in the Senate. They have the backing of the federal courts. And, you know, this is it's an anti-democratic thing, but it's a party thing. It's an ideological thing. And it's not personal to Donald Trump, right? Like if he passed away and Mike Pence became president, I think a lot of stuff would change in terms of wild and crazy antics. But like Republicans would continue to be pedal to the metal on the idea that like public opinion and majority rule are not normatively significant. And then you have a third thing, which is personalism. So like Trump, people are talking about maybe TikTok should be banned or restricted in some way. And the way a traditional president would do that is like convene the CFIUS panel and take advantage of the fact that Chuck Schumer had been calling for this to make sure it's done in a bipartisan way with everybody bought in, with a lot of lawyers paying attention to what are the details, because you're trying to show that this is like real policymaking in a liberal society. And Trump does the opposite of that, right? He just like says like, we're going to ban it. And then everybody runs around and they're like, wait. Instead of banning it, well, maybe we should let Microsoft buy it. So then Trump says, well, maybe we should let Microsoft buy it. But really, because I'd helped them get a great price, like they should pay money to the Treasury. And that's like Banana Republic type stuff, which I think people don't even like to say because it's not fair necessarily to Central America. So Trump does a lot of that too. And that's the area where he sometimes gets pushback from Republicans, right? Who want to curb it on the one man freelancing sort of aspect of Trumpism. But the other two are also very present and I think alarm people in a more visceral kind of way, because they're sort of visible. But if you think about like what four more years of Trump would mean, I think you really have to, like Trump specifically, as opposed to some other Republican, I think you really have to worry about the integrity of the legal and regulatory process of this kind of like TikToking of everything. You shared in Slack earlier today, I think it was you, this story about like Wall Street people like don't want to donate to Trump anymore. So like, what if he comes back in like ready for vengeance, right? Like these are the donors who abandoned me and I proved them wrong. And now we're going to, you know, sick the SEC or the U.S. Attorney's Office and on those kind of people. And it's been the dog that I don't want to say it hasn't barked of the Trump administration, but it keeps being like a little less bad than I worry because other Republicans do restrain him. But the longer he stays in and the better he does, the less restrained he becomes.
So a couple things here. I actually just this week released on the Ezra Klein Show an episode with political scientists Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. And it's actually a very weedsy episode, so people listening here might go check it out. But they have this book about, it's called Let Them Eat Tweets, which I like the book a lot, and the name I think undersells it a little. But they're looking at plutocratic populism and the ways in which the sort of economic royalist wing of the GOP and the white resentment politics wing of the GOP feed into each other. And one of the arguments they make that I think gets, it's like not the sexier argument in the book. So I think it's getting like a little bit less attention, but I really think it's important and wrote about it in my review of the book as well, is that they basically argue that Trump's vividly strongman tendencies, his almost cosplaying of an authoritarian attempt, is actually distracting people from the true undermining of our democracy, which is the Republican Party's unified effort to take control and keep control of American politics using pathways of minoritarian power, like the Senate, the Electoral College, to some degree the House, the Supreme Court, which is dominated by Republicans because of minoritarian victories at the presidential and Senate levels, and then to use that control to reshape American institutions through Supreme Court rulings, through gerrymandering, et cetera, through voter ID laws, such that minoritarian strategies are ever more capable. Their sort of basic argument is that one convergence of the white identitarians and the plutocrats is both of them have lost faith in democracy. The plutocrats never had it, right, for all the sort of long-time political theory reasons you cite, Matt. But the white identitarians, they are for the first real time facing the possibility that they will not be the majority, that sort of like white identity, like ethno-nationalist politics can't win on its own. They've often tried to restrict the franchise, but not because they couldn't win if like the small percentage of America that was non-white could vote. But now that's actually become more true. And I think this is really correct, that there's a certain relief I've heard like liberals express and feel, because while Trump seems to want to become a strongman leader, he's not capable of doing it, or maybe institutions are not letting him do it, or the Supreme Court has put some boundaries on what he can do. And that's all true. And it's good that like Trump has not become Il Duce. But on the other hand, it is somehow in the background almost normalized the unbelievably undemocratic situation we're in, where, you know, the Supreme Court, the presidency, and the Senate are all held by the party that won fewer votes. That party is in many, many ways at many levels, including at the state level, making it easier to win without winning more votes, making it easier for money to like buy votes, etc. And that's really scary. So it's a slightly different point, I know, than the one you're making, Matt, and I take your point on regulatory corruption. But I think something that just like is going to happen here is that people are going to pat themselves on the back a little bit if Donald Trump loses in November and say, haha, American democracy survived, when given the judicial appointments he's made and 100 other things that have happened, if Democrats don't take seriously the need to make sure America is small d democratic and roll a lot of this back in a pretty substantial way, America as a democracy where majorities can push their preferences into policy is really going to die. And so it may be that in like a huge wipeout, Democrats can win. But in general, like it just doesn't work that way anymore. And I think that would be a real dangerous set of political incentives to see take root. And Donald Trump has been sort of like is happy to benefit from them. But it's like behind him that the real patient funded work is happening to happen. So that, I think, is the real danger here. Not that, in the background of what Trump has been doing frontally and sort of not being able to do frontally, has been this real patient work that the Republican Party is going to keep working on. And so there's an authoritarian threat, but there's also just a minoritarianism threat that seems to me to be more direct. And somehow I almost think Trump has normalized it in comparison, because like that stuff works off of the norms and structures of American politics. It looks less alien than Donald Trump wandering around and being like, I'm going to delay the election. But if you make elections not really matter, at least not in the way they traditionally were understood to matter by like representing the public's voice, like you've done potentially worse damage over time.
I think the point you were sort of closing on, right, it reminds me of the fact that there have been sort of two different lines of critique of Trump, right, or of like Trump era politics. And one uses the word populism a lot, right? And I think of Yasha Munk's book and some others. And, you know, the idea there is really, I would say less in terms of populism than a sort of old fashioned idea of the demagogue, right? The idea that somebody is going to like whip people up and topple the establishment and wreck democracy. But the other, the one that Hacker and Pearson write about, because they wrote their other book off center years ago, when like the idea of Donald Trump becoming president would have been laughable then. And what they are worried about is the opposite of populism, right? They are worried about plutocracy. And I think that there is a lot of wisdom fundamentally in their view that that is the greater worry about America. That if you look at something like how often it's been the case that in red states, you know, Democrats have not been able to expand Medicaid because Republicans don't like it. But Medicaid expansion polls really well. So in some states, there's an initiative and referendum process. So they've gone to the voters and won. But then typically, Republican state legislatures, when they've been in power, have tried to sabotage implementation of those initiatives. Or you had the example in Wisconsin where the lame duck gerrymandered state legislature changed the Constitution to take powers away from the governor. And this is like, Trump never once tweeted about Wisconsin state politics there. This is just how the Republican Party at an institutional level wants to act. And it is, it's not that the like Trump authoritarian populist stuff doesn't happen, but that I think focusing on it in a way takes focus away from, and not just in a sense of distracts, but like thematically, it's the reverse, right? Like if you get yourself so geared up to the idea that, look, we need to beat Trump and then the threat will be gone, but then we need to be real sticklers for institutional integrity and like never say anything mean about federal courts, never deride formal processes, never claim that we speak for the authentic people. I think that's going to be a real dangerous unilateral disarmament for Democrats who are going to need to, at certain points, press the case outside the formal boundaries of the political system, that there is something normatively wrong with a gerrymandered state legislature changing the rules ex post so that their power can't be checked, right? That's like, that's when people need to be out in the streets. It's when you need some populism, right? Like pressure needs to be brought to bear because the rules of the system have been rigged. And, you know, I mean, this has always been an anxiety of mine about Biden, an anxiety of mine about the whole literature on Trump and democracy, because there's so much more happening than Donald Trump.
I think it's a good place to close it, but I think that's right. There's always so much more happening than Donald Trump.
You know what is happening that's not Donald Trump that I unconscionably forgot to mention is that I have a book that is coming out and I'm trying to get pre-orders for. It is called 1 Billion Americans. It is amazing. It is blurbed by Ezra Klein, as well as many other superstar figures. And, you know, if you buy it and you tweet your proof of purchase, I am going to enter you into my drawing for one lucky 1 Billion Americans pre-orderer to select a white paper of the week that I will subject Darren Jane to. So keep that in mind. Thanks, Ezra. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors. Thanks to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. And the Weeds will be back on Tuesday.